This is CliffCentral.com.
Welcome back to Brain and Brands with Dr. Tara Swart and myself. Dr. Swart is neuroscientist and author of Neuroscience for Leadership. Dr. Swart, welcome back to Brain and Brands.
Thanks for having me back.
I am really excited about the next sort of three-part series where we explore, you know, the whole idea and the power of executive function. You know, I want to start the show with a quote by Viktor Frankl in Man's Search for Meaning, where he says, between stimulus and response, there is space. In that space is our power to choose our response. In our response lies our growth and our freedom. Forces beyond our control can take away everything you possess except one thing, your freedom to choose how you will respond in that situation. And at the end of the day, that's what we're going to be discussing.
I love that quote. And actually, you know, in terms of the science, it's really about what we call free will, but also free won't. So it's the choice to not do things as well as to do things, which I think is, you know, super cool and really relevant in the modern world.
Awesome. This three-part series will focus on the connection between brain, bodies, and business, a systems approach sparked by your conversation with Dr. Peter Hurst, MBE, Executive Director of MIT Sloan School of Management. You guys went into a meeting and this thing just sort of came out, right?
Yeah, so he's actually the associate dean now, so I think we should get that in there, because I'm very proud of him and what he's done for, you know, bringing neuroscience into business and leadership at MIT Sloan. So he introduced me to some people at the Brain and Cognitive Science Unit at MIT, wow. And they started talking about executive functions. And then he said something, and I realized he was talking about the functions that an executive in a business carries out. And I said, hold on a second. I think we should make it very clear that the neuroscience term executive functions actually means something specific and different. Although, funnily enough, you know, being able to master these executive functions is probably what makes a leader successful. So there's definitely a connection. So I was like, hold up. Okay, here's the definition. And basically, you know, I like to say the brain is the CEO of the body.
Yes.
And the prefrontal cortex is pretty much the CEO of the brain. And it's the part that's to do with articulated speech and planning and predicting for the future. So that's the generalization. But the specific executive functions are things like being able to regulate your emotions, being able to suppress your unconscious biases, solve complex problems, think flexibly and creatively, and to multitask, or what I prefer to call task switching.
Got it. Awesome. So, you know, sort of a broad look at our goals over the next three podcasts will be exactly that, along with agility of thinking, adaptability, tolerance for ambiguity, and hopefully we'll get to, you know, how people can enable some creativity, structure rewards, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm very thrilled. And again, you know, this podcast series is a three-part series each time we do it. And we've structured it this way to sort of maximize the time, but also to provide a chunk of insights into small bites. And so I want to start by saying it's really been important for me on this process, as well as I know when I conduct seminars, and I've noticed also when you speak as well, that you try to simplify this language. So I know a lot of scientists often get caught up with the sort of, you know, almost like the dogma and the rigor of the science, and people sort of miss out on the simplicity of it. How do you feel about simplifying this for our listeners?
You know, we're totally on the same page. My passion is to take the science and say, what does this mean for a real person every day in their life? And although, you know, I understand, having been a sort of academic research scientist myself, I understand that there's a fine line between making it practically applicable and making it so simple that it's no longer sort of true to the science. And I think you have to tread that line very carefully. But at the end of the day, I'm much more interested in, is this practically applicable? Is this actually going to help people? Is it going to change people's lives? And that's why I was so thrilled when we won that award recently from the Chartered Management Institute for Practical Manager Book of the Year. That was the category that I would have wanted to win.
Congratulations. Yeah. I didn't know that.
Yeah, thank you. It's very recent. So I'm really thrilled. It just makes me feel like the reason I wrote the book has been recognized. And hopefully these podlets will do exactly the same thing. They'll give people actual things that they can go away and do starting today that will make a difference to their life.
So continuing in this vein, particularly in this first podlet in this series, you know, the prefrontal lobes, if you look at the brain, it would be sort of like the front part of the brain. But ultimately, it's not the only part of the brain that's responsible for decision making, or am I wrong?
No, you're absolutely right. I really like people to think of the brain as a very complex, dynamic system that's cascading responses all over it. So, you know, anything that happens in the limbic system has an effect on the prefrontal cortex and vice versa. And, you know, even down to a much smaller scale than that. So what I don't want is to, you know, us to use the analogy of like the accounting department and the marketing department work in complete isolation from each other.
Sure.
It should be that, you know, everything that's happening in one part is affecting everything that's happening in another part. Just like it is in brains, it's like that in businesses.
Okay. And when it comes to the reason why, you know, if we look back throughout evolutionary history, you know, the prefrontal lobes is not necessarily new, but it is not, I mean, is it the newest part of the brain?
Yeah, so it's newer, and it's the newest part of the brain. It's the outer frontal part of the brain that we're talking about. And sort of, you know, the brain, there's always been a brain stem. Even reptiles have a brain stem. And then there was the limbic system, which is the more emotional, intuitive part of the brain, which is heavily involved in decision making. You know, it biases all of our decisions. And then we grew this much larger cortex than we had before, or than any other primate has. And we're not quite sure if that grew and then we discovered how to make fire and cook meat, or whether we discovered fire and then we could ingest a lot more protein and we didn't need such a long gut and we were able to grow that part of our brain and get those sort of capabilities like predicting and planning for the future and starting to actually speak with words rather than just grunting and gesturing.
Sure. Okay. And whether people realize it or not, it impacts all of our lives on so many levels. Even you look around the world and everything from when you get your driver's license to when you're allowed to drink is largely determined by when this area of the brain matures.
Don't you think it's weird, though, that you're allowed to drive before you're allowed to drink? Not strange.
Yeah, I know growing up in America, you know, I got my learner's permit at 15 years old, which is a long ways away from drinking.
Yeah, I know.
So the prefrontal, this region fully matures at around, I mean, there's been a lot of debate, but a lot of consensus somewhere between, 19 and 21?
You know, I think the jury's really out on that now that we've, you know, learned so much more about neuroplasticity. I think the reason that we're doing these podlets is because what we're saying is it doesn't matter how old you are, you can still change and improve your prefrontal cortex.
Okay.
Sure, it may not be growing, you know, at the rate that it did till you were about 19 to 21. There are activities that you can do to keep it as plastic and flexible as possible, you know, to become better at regulating your emotions, to be able to feel more confident about solving complex problems or thinking outside the box. I really, you know, if there's one message that we want people to take away from this, it's that you can still change and improve things that you thought you weren't good at.
Got it. In terms of the role of neuroplasticity, let's just sort of break that down. Apparently there are three main mechanisms in neuroplasticity. One is myelination, synaptic connection, and neurogenesis. Let's simplify that, because those words, I think I barely even said them properly.
You know, I mean, these processes themselves are not things that I really think people need to know about, but I'll tell you why they're important in terms of playing to your strengths. So myelination is this process of adding this fatty outer layer to the neurons or nerves that we have in our brains and our bodies. And the neurons that have that fatty layer conduct the chemical and electrical messages quicker than the neurons that don't.
Okay.
So things like, for example, if you put your finger in a fire by mistake, then the heat response will be very quick and you'd withdraw your hand quickly. And then it would take a little bit longer for the pain to register. So it's kind of like the heat response is myelinated and the pain response is slower.
Okay.
Because it's probably not myelinated. So myelination is kind of like what people do when they practice weights at the gym. It sort of builds up a capability that you have already. And it's pretty simple to do just by repetitive practice.
Okay.
The sign up to genesis just means that, because the synapse is the space between two neurons, and it means creating more connections between neurons. And that's not that difficult to do either. If you focus a lot of attention and you practice something really deliberately, you know, like say learning a new language, you should be able to do that. It might take some time and effort, but you would be able to do it.
Okay.
The neurogenesis is actually about growing new nerve cells from little embryonic nerve cells. And that doesn't happen an awful lot in the adult brain. It happens more than we thought it used, you know, we used to think it did. But to actually induce that process, you pretty much have to give up your day job. So that's why we say play to your strengths. Don't suddenly try to start playing the piano if you've never played a musical instrument and you can't read music. Although there's lots of good, you know, good things about learning a musical instrument. If it's so out of your comfort zone, then maybe it might be better if you learn a new language instead. Do you see what I mean?
Absolutely. Okay, cool. So neuroplasticity, the bottom line is that, as you said rightly, we are having these podcasts because we want people to know that irrespective of their age, there is capacity, additional capacity that historically people didn't think there was. And I want to just sort of shift as we continue to raise the awareness of why this conversation is important to the hippocampus, or however you pronounce it. You know, this region sort of grows with increasing knowledge and so forth. Could you just sort of break down the role? I mean, there was a study done around the taxi drivers in London and how that region of the brain grew the more they sort of remembered. So what's that role of the brain as it relates to this conversation?
It's interesting you picked on the hippocampus because that's one area that we have seen active neurogenesis. We haven't seen it anywhere else in the brain yet, but I suspect we will. It's just a matter of time. So the hippocampus is mostly to do with memory. And there's a little part of it that's particularly to do with memory and navigation. And so in London, the licensed taxi drivers do a process called the knowledge, where they learn every street in London off by heart. And, you know, this is kind of more attention intense than learning a new language. It's a huge amount of learning. And after this process is complete, which takes anything from months to years, that part of the hippocampus that's to do with navigation has physically grown in size and density. And we've seen that on brain scanning. But actually the most sort of probably the most important part of the hippocampus is that it connects memory and emotion. So the more emotionally intense a memory is, or the more times you've experienced it, the more you're going to lay down a strong memory of whatever that scenario was. And, you know, that's something that you can have choice around as well. You know, you can reduce the emotional impact of a situation. That's kind of how we deal with stress. Or you can repeat something so that it becomes an embedded memory. You know, that's just the process of learning in the brain is sort of quite largely based on repetition.
Now, with technology and apps and, you know, disruptive sort of brands like Uber, these taxi drivers may not need to remember. So, you know, using them as sort of an analogy, how is technology and the fact that we become so sort of dependent upon technology for memory, how is it impacting this region of the brain?
Oh, well, I mean, it's been the case for years now, pretty much since smartphones became popular, that most, you know, our memory and concentration centers have shrunk already. I mean, it hasn't even taken that long for that to sort of show up in our generation. And, you know, there's an increase in the rise of things like ADHD and Asperger's disease. And some people believe that that's to do with the sort of amount of information overload that we have through our devices. You know, I mean, it's a little bit like man discovering fire, which I talked about before. We can't stop it. Technology is happening to us. And, you know, we've probably already passed the point where it's going to take over a lot of our capabilities. So I think in terms of these disruptive technologies, you've just got to stay one step ahead. You talked about, you know, ambiguity tolerance and being adaptable. Those are the key skills that we need going forward. You know, relying on technical skills, it's not going to be enough. Because the question you need to ask yourself is, can a robot do these technical skills? And if they can, then they probably will be in a few years' time.
Awesome. At the center of this conversation in our first potlet, we are exploring why it is important to understand that there is capacity, additional capacity and additional opportunity for control for you as a leader as you explore your personal growth and pursue your personal dreams, that you have an opportunity. As I started the podcast with Viktor Frankl's quote, between what happens to you and how you respond, there is space. I want to conclude this first sort of podlet by saying the quote from Robert E. Lee, "I cannot trust a man to control others who cannot control himself." And I believe that every great leader demonstrates the opportunity or the a very strong sort of personal reputation and image that you can count on me to make better decisions. No one is perfect, but we can see through the entire world right now with leaders and what's happening with Brexit, what's happening with Donald Trump, what's happening with emerging market leaders in Brazil, that we want and we need leaders who can exercise better decisions and control. On our next podlet with Dr. Swart, we will be exploring specific sort of areas of executive function, how it can impact your career specifically. Dr. Swart, I'd like to thank you for this first part in the series, and we look forward to part two.
CliffCentral.com.
All right, welcome back to Brain and Brands with Dr. Tara Swart, author of Neuroscience for Leadership. And we have decided to come together to help leaders understand how to have a better sort of control over themselves and their leadership capacity by understanding the relationship between their brain and their brand. Dr. Swart, welcome back to Brain and Brands.
Thank you.
In part one, we really sort of looked at creating an awareness and an opportunity to and why it is so important to understand executive function. And you shared with us your thoughts and so forth. I'd like to move to more sort of contextualizing this conversation, you know, particularly in this region of the world. And I think across the world, there is a huge challenge that the world is facing, which really just understanding what we want from a leader. I mentioned at the end of our last potlet that the world is searching. I actually don't know any country, and maybe you can help me out. Is there any country in the world where they're happy with their leader?
Yeah, it's a funny time for the world at the moment, isn't it, Timothy? It's
it really
just
is.
Really destabilizing. And from the neuroscience point of view, what I see from the leaders that I coach and what I see from what's going on in the world is that at times like this, what people really want from a leader is transparency.
Absolutely. And we need transparency in a major way, when particularly because the world is being thrust on its head when it comes to things like embracing diversity. There are many women that I've interviewed in my series on CNBC Africa who are the first in their position, and up to 30% of them have had nervous breakdowns. People of color who are the first. We're in a very fascinating chapter of history. And also people who are of every race, whites, black, all types of people who are confronted with overwhelming change and newness.
Yeah.
And we need the best of what our brains can offer if we're going to navigate this complex period in history. So I'm really thrilled about having this particular conversation. I think it's extremely critical that people are aware that this is a serious chapter in history. I think the world is being redefined. More is being called upon of our brains to be able to sort of navigate this space. And we are in a maturing sort of phase where we're needing to mature, because democracy has been sort of cut up, sliced apart, and redefined right in front of our eyes. When it comes to some of what you've observed as you explore leading and working with some of the top leaders around the world, what do you see that some of the best leaders are doing to make sure they have more control in this executive region of the brain?
It's really interesting that you've used the word control, because I think that one of the biggest threats to the brain, you know, whether you're a leader of a huge corporation or a team leader or a project manager or a leader of your family or yourself, is the threat is change that you don't feel that you're in control of. So actually, rather than just change, I like to use the word uncontrollability. So, you know, I think people are actually quite good at change, considering everything that's going on. We're doing okay, but it's when you feel that you can't control it, that starts to threaten your brain, and it starts to actually move the blood supply away from the prefrontal cortex, where you have these higher executive functions, where you can put in the pause, where you can choose how to behave, and it starts to move the blood supply with the glucose and oxygen that the brain needs towards the survival centers, where you tend to be more reactive, and you tend to sort of be less likely to collaborate, because that will use up your precious resources. So just at the time that you need to be at your best, often we're not. And when you talked about control for a leader, I think that from a neuroscience point of view, what that actually means is the ability to regulate your emotions and to understand, be aware of other people's emotions and be compassionate towards them, but not get sucked into their emotions. Wow. So it's really about managing yourself, having the right level of empathy, but not, you know, not too much emotion involved in any meeting, decision, context. So, you know, having enough but not too much emotion in a situation, and really being so mindful and aware of that. And if you've got multiple demands on you, if you're being criticized in the press, it can be really difficult to make the time and space for that, but it's more vital than ever.
Got it. And, you know, if you're just joining us and this is your first time listening, Dr. Swart and colleagues wrote Neuroscience for Leadership. And this is we're really exploring chapter, I think it's chapter 2, looking at brains, bodies, and business. And Dr. Swart is a lecturer at the Sloan School of Management. And what we're looking at in this part two is practically dealing with diversity, dealing with leadership challenges, dealing with ambiguity, dealing with change and so forth, and our capacity to do so. You know, getting people often struggle when you are labeled leader, when you are a sort of positioned as a pioneer, there's enormous pressure, and it's often very difficult to open up to people about what you're facing. If you don't have anywhere to turn, what recommendations do you have if you are a woman and you're the first in a position, or if you are white and you are taking on a challenge? And I don't like to really discuss the race thing, but in South Africa and most places in the world, it's a reality. If you are whatever you are, and you're the first to be doing what you're doing, and you face an enormous pressure, what are some of the things that you can do to sort of relieve this pressure and exercise a bit more control?
Look, as I think you know, I have clients of literally every different color in South Africa. And so I do believe that coaching has been very, very important to these people. The challenges that they're facing, not only superficially in the businesses, but also, you know, you just have to scratch the surface to find out that deep down there's a lot more going on for, you know, people of every race, no matter how successful, wealthy, educated, intelligent they are. So, you know, the thing is, you don't know what you don't know, and your perception is your reality. So having an objective external sounding board for your thoughts is huge. And, you know, obviously senior leaders can afford to have coaching, but if you've got a friend, a confidant, a buddy, a mentor, you know, a friend who's a psychologist, then, you know, these are the sort of great people to talk to. Obviously, family and friends are good, but I always say family and friends should stay as family and friends, not become your, you know, your business coach or your doctor.
Yes.
You don't want to damage those, you know, really positive, meaningful relationships by sort of talking about work stress all the time. But, you know, you can to some extent. If people don't have somebody that they can reach out to, then I suggest people doing journaling. So even writing down your thoughts and feelings and the results of your decision making is better than just keeping it inside and bottling it up. And, you know, there are some habit tracking apps and things now which are quite, I find quite useful for making sure that you're sticking to the right sorts of physical and mental behaviors that will help to keep you in peak condition mentally and emotionally. And then there's things like gratitude lists and accomplishment lists and sort of, you know, mindfulness meditation. These are the things that I really suggest for people to be able to press that pause button
with you. And, you know, it's interesting. In July, August 2013, you guys, you know, you wrote about how in a Harvard Business Review article by Adam Waits and Malia Mason, that, I mean, they really argue that leadership is difficult to define. Could that be part of the challenge, that people don't even know what to expect from a leader?
Yeah, I mean, I think if you asked your listeners now to sort of like, you know, chat in about what is a leader, what's leadership, you get hundreds of different answers. You get a different answer from every person. That's absolutely one of the problems. I love that article by Adam and Malia. I think it's absolutely right, basing on the premise that we don't even have a clear definition for leadership, so how can we apply neuroscience to it? And that's why it's important to break it down into the, you know, executive functions, the what you actually need to do to achieve what you want, and then say, well, what's the science behind that? How can we make it easier for you to do that? How can you understand yourself better in that regard?
Got it. When it comes to those who are slightly skeptical of, you know, things like mindfulness and EQ, your book highlights this, the conversation around volition. Can you explain that a little bit more?
Mm. So that's about your desire to do something. And actually that comes from some experiments on rats where they were split into groups that did forced voluntary and involuntary exercise. So let me just tell the story in the simplest possible form. So let's take three groups of rats. One group kept in a confined space, didn't do any exercise. One group forced to run on a treadmill for a certain number of minutes or hours per day. And the third group allowed to roam around freely, get on a treadmill when and if they wanted to, stay on it for as long as they wanted to.
Okay.
And what we see is that the two exercising groups get the benefits of oxygenation of the brain. Oxygen is one of the main resources for the brain. But only the group that did exercise when they wanted to released a growth factor in the brain called BDNF, or brain-derived neurotrophic factor. And this relates back to what we were talking about in the first part of these podlets on neurogenesis. So that growth factor actually allows us to grow new nerve cells from little embryonic nerve cells. So that's, I mean, that's huge. And this was just about exercise, but then, you know, let's extrapolate that to work or life. It means that if you do something that you really want to, that you've got a passion for and a desire for, your brain will actually help you and grow in that direction. You know, it'll make it easier for you to do that. And I think that's got big implications for what projects you put people on, or, you know, what tasks you ask teams to do. And, you know, obviously what activities you do in your personal life that boost your brain, whether it's exercise, social, learning, whatever.
Got it. Carol Dweck at Stanford University wrote about mind shift, moving from type 1 mindset to type 2 mindset, really sort of exploring moving from sort of a fearful position to a growth-based position. Can you unpack that a little bit further?
Yeah, so I really like this work by Carol. It's I think the phrases I like the most that make sense are moving from a fixed mindset to a growth or learning mindset. And she sort of puts people in, you know, either of the two categories to start off with. But with the neuroplasticity research, it's becoming apparent that you can move along the spectrum from fixed to learning. So the fixed mindset would be, you know, someone who's had very high standards, who's kind of done well at school, got a good job, kind of has to be a bit perfect. You know, doesn't really like any failure, doesn't like too many challenges because it might show up that we're not perfect. Maybe tends to be a bit less honest about any imperfections, quite critical, self-critical, maybe that leaks out into being quite critical of others. And, you know, in her research, she says that people like that are less likely to collaborate. So that's kind of the one extreme. On the other side, in the growth mindset, we have people who believe that, you know, there's an opportunity to learn from everything, including failures and challenges. So they will embrace challenges. They will just think, what can I learn from this failure? They're happy to fail fast and often and, you know, try lots of different things. And they, you know, they look at people who are smarter than them and think, wouldn't it be great to be a bit more like that? But they don't feel like that makes them, you know, feel bad about themselves. And they would tend to be more collaborative. So I think that sometimes we're one way at work and a different way at home. And it's just quite good to you know, just Google some of that research and sort of see what the attributes are and say, well, you know, where am I on this spectrum when I'm at home with the kids, for example? And where am I when I'm on this spectrum in a really stressful work project? And how can I try to stay or move towards being more open to learning and growth and innovation? Because, you know, going back to what I said about ambiguity tolerance and, you know, uncontrollable change and the fact that our technical skills aren't really going to be enough going forward, things like emotional intelligence and mindfulness are actually going to become even more important going forward than they are already. And, you know, I think before we had evidence from brain scanning, I could understand why people were skeptical about those sorts of things. But the evidence is overwhelming now that mindfulness activities physically change the structure of your brain and that they alter the neuroendocrine system, which is the communication between our glands and our, you know, our hormones and our nerves. So I think that the evidence is too strong now to ignore things like mindfulness. The US Marines are using it, and I strongly believe that people in stressful leadership positions and just in businesses generally would also massively benefit from it.
So in this era of high complexity where there's extraordinary change, there's a lack of clarity, et cetera, any leader who wants to thrive must fully embrace the fact that there is this opportunity and there are these spaces that we can explore. It's really awesome. I've been really enjoying this series myself. And as always, I'm learning and I'm growing myself and I'm looking forward to literally implementing what we've been sharing and so forth. And I think just the awareness alone is just very, very profitable for myself. And the feedback we're getting has been really, really positive. So thank you very much. In this part three of our Potlet series, we're going to look at the sort of five fundamentals and sort of key tips that you can sort of take away to really begin sort of implementing these executive control sort of strategies in this brain, bodies, and business series. Let's start with number one.
So I actually want to preface this by saying that you mentioned the brain-body connection in part two of the Podlet series, and I want to take that a bit further and say that physical, mental, emotional, and spiritual health and wealth, or capital, are intimately connected. They all affect each other.
Okay.
And the one we need to start with, really, is the physical foundation. And so these five fundamentals are quite physical, but to have that higher executive function part of your brain firing on all cylinders, we need to have the physical foundations in place. We can't really be talking about mental diversity of thinking, emotional intelligence, creativity, unless we know that the, you know, the machinery is actually has all the conditions for it to be successful. So I would say the first one is about resting your brain and your body.
Okay.
You know, we need to sleep for 8 hours a night, 7 to 9 hours, they say. When you wake up in the morning after a good night's sleep, you have a bucket of what I call cognitive resources, so your ability to think for that day.
Okay.
And the length and quality of your sleep and the consistency of that will be the first step in making sure that you're able to access your higher executive functions as well as possible for as long as possible throughout the day.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I see. I mean, this is critical. This is a critical point for me, is that even if you are aware and if you are, have been working on it, if you're, if you don't have the amount of rest and sleep, you still may not be able to access that, that ability to control or expand or grow.
Yeah, I mean, you know, they say that after a night of disturbed sleep, you're operating on an apparent IQ loss of 5 to 8 points. Now, most of our listeners would still be able to carry out their job perfectly well if they had like 5 to 8 IQ points less than they generally do, you know, that they've got access to using. But after a whole night's sleep disruption, like being on a flight or having a sick child, then the in a population norm study, the IQ drops by one standard deviation, which would drop us all below normal IQ. And I know that, you know, with my traveling, if it's a significant jet lag time difference, you know, it feels like I'm sort of mentally confused. I actually don't work the day after a big trip because I can't handle figures and details in the same way that I can on a good day.
Got it. Awesome. So resting your brain and body to be able to access this control capacity is critical.
Mm-hmm.
Number two.
And then I think the second most important one is probably nutrition. So our brains only weigh 2 to 3% of our body weight, but the brain sucks up 25 to 30% of the nutrients that we break down from our diet.
Okay.
So having a healthy, balanced diet, eating regularly, because the brain can't store the glucose that it gets from our diet for any length of time. It sucks it up immediately, uses it, and then the rest goes to the bodily functions. But, you know, I think that people realize that trying to eat healthily is good for your physical well-being. But imagine that a quarter to a third of what you're eating is actually going to your brain power. I don't think that people are thinking about that so consciously.
That's incredible. So if I eat like a bag of chips and that's it, a quarter of those chips are going to, and that's probably not the best fuel to be putting in the brain.
No, because, you know, especially a bag of chips, it's like it's got those bad fats that you don't really want going to your brain, which hardens the cell membranes between, you know, membranes between our cells. So what you want to be doing is putting in lots of good fats and good oils and water-rich foods. So, you know, obviously fruit and vegetables, but the avocados, the olives, the nuts, the salmon, the eggs, the things that have those good omega oils. Coconut oil is another, has become so popular because it's literally like rocket fuel for your brain. There's evidence that for 20 minutes after eating a spoonful of coconut oil, your cognitive ability is enhanced. So I just stir some into my tea in the morning and I'm kind of like, okay, I've had my coconut oil for the day.
Got it.
So yeah, just, you know, generally good nutrition, but the regularity of it's important. What you eat in terms of brain friendly food is important. Things like green teas are good as well. Actually, I'll save that for the third point, which is about hydration. But yeah, the nutrition thing, it's really worth looking into. We have a couple of blogs on my website, The Unlimited Mind, on brain-friendly nutrition.
Got it. Okay, and this is, before we get to point number three, your website is www.the-unlimited-mind.com.
Yeah.
Awesome. Okay. Point number three.
Point number three is related, so it's hydration. We need to hydrate the neurons in our system because if you're 1% to 3% dehydrated, then they can't send the electrical and chemical messages between them as efficiently. And that's when your memory and concentration and decision-making power start to suffer. By the time you're thirsty, you're way more than 3% dehydrated. So it's something you really need to work to keep on top of. We suggest 0.5 liter of water for every 15 kilos or 30 pounds of your body weight per day. So, you know, that's anything from 1.5 to 3 liters per day for the average woman or man.
Yes, yes.
If you drink a lot of caffeine, you need to drink more water to make up for the water loss. If you're having alcohol, you need to drink more water to replace the water that you'd lose by urinating, because caffeine and alcohol have a diuretic effect on the body, so we lose water overall. So I think, you know, that's such a small thing, but I'm always shocked by how little water executives are drinking. I get my executives to do a food and drink diary for a week, and usually the thing we argue over is the water consumption.
And to make it very clear, I think that, you know, people have heard similar stuff for many years, even at school and so forth. But I think that if people can see that before they go into a big presentation, before they go into a negotiating deal that's going to be highly stressful, that's going to require so much of their brain, that if they're not hydrated, they risk probably not being able to give it all to that exercise.
Totally. I mean, I would never go to a coaching session without eating something first. I feel like it's not fair on that person.
Yeah. They're paying for you to be your best brain to be there.
Exactly. And it's the same with drinking water. I mean, it's now the law in the UK that all school children must have water in their bag with them because we know about how it affects, you know, your brain's ability.
Oh,
and I always say, yeah, why don't we have that at businesses? Why don't we have that at business schools as a, you know, it's routine.
That's incredible. So I think we actually need to roll out a plan, particularly here in this part of the world, to have water in before people go. I was in a workshop recently at one of the top law firms, and I kind of felt like these people need water.
Yeah, I know. I mean, well, law firms usually need sleep as well.
Yeah, that's true.
They're particularly guilty of not sleeping.
So number one was resting your body. your brain and body. Number two is nutrition and understanding that, you know, the fact that the brain is sucking up 20-25% of your energy. Number three is hydration. Number four?
Oxygenation. So, you know, ideally, we are not sedentary during the day and we're walking around and we're exerting ourselves at times and, you know, we're sort of, you know, taking some deeper breaths because of the activity that we're doing. But I'm guessing that a lot of our listeners are just sat at a desk in an office for long periods of time. And if that's the case, then doing formal exercise at a gym or outdoors is, you know, it's not better than being active all day, but it's second best to that. So if you do have a sedentary job, try to do formal exercise. They say 150 minutes a week of raising your metabolism by 2 to 3 times. So glucose and oxygen, glucose from the nutrition and oxygen from the exercise or just breathing are the two main resources for the brain. So you were just saying, you know, don't go to a high stakes meeting without drinking enough water. And I was saying, or without eating something, but actually even just taking 10 deep breaths or doing, you know, some kind of meditation where there is breath counting or deep breathing before a high stakes meeting will give your brain that extra oxygen boost.
Oh, wow. Love it. Okay, that's very clear. Let's move to point number five.
Have we done four? Oh, yeah, we've done four. So point number five is really about simplicity and choice reduction. So our brain likes simplicity, but we don't live in a simple world at all anymore. So, you know, we're bombarded with information. We're sort of on 24 hours a day if we want to be and if we can be. So it's about trying to bring... You know, at times we want people to do the neuroplasticity thing and learn something new and go and explore and be curious. But at stressful times, when there's lots of change going on, particularly change that you can't control, it's really nice to be able to control something and make it simpler. And even that, even if that's just, you know, laying out your clothes for the next day, the night before, so that in the morning your routine's a little bit more simple, even if it's kind of just having the same breakfast every day at the same time so that there's just that regularity. And, you know, when I'm traveling a lot, I always stay at the same place. You know, I always stay at the same place in Joburg. I always stay at the same place in New York, Oslo. I just try to keep things as familiar and routine as possible when I know that the demands on my brain are higher.
Oh, wow. That makes complete sense. I mean, I imagine that applies to relationships as well. I mean, if you're going to be dating different people, it could really cause a lot of complexity.
You've been so well behaved until now, Timothy, but I might have guessed that something like that was going to get mentioned. So, yeah, okay. That's a lot of complexity that you don't really need to bring into your life.
Thank you so much. Awesome. And sort of compartmentalize, and I have to say that for me as well, that I noticed that before I speak, like the night before, if I'm completely prepared, and like you said, everything is laid out and I know where everything is, I usually speak better the next day. And I'm only sort of making that link now as you sort of describe this and sort of compartmentalizing, having some people on your team who understand the demands on your schedule. I'm sure that could be extremely important as well, having associates, team members, assistants, and so forth, because this conversation is really driven towards influencers and executives and so forth. So how important is it that your team are aware of all of this?
Oh, it's vitally important. You know, if I think about my own team, because obviously I'm out there talking about neuroscience and, you know, they know what I talk about and they know that I try to run my life and our, you know, the way that our team works based on some simple applications of neuroscience. So, you know, one of the things, for example, is that if I get too many emails during the day, then it's constantly distracting for me and I can't focus on a task. So particularly when I'm traveling a lot, we have an arrangement where, you know, they only send me one email a day at the end of the day. And, you know, they're also very good about kind of creating a seamless travel experience for me. And, you know, sort of giving me as much information up front as possible to sort of, you know, manage any changes that might come up. I don't do this, but it's the reason that Mark Zuckerberg wears the same clothes every day and that, you know, Steve Jobs pretty much did the same.
Wow.
No. So it's about choice reduction, yeah, and simplification.
Well, this brings us to the end of our three-part series. Thank you for those five fundamentals. And, of course, what I love about this pod, you can just go to rewind and go back and sort of recap them and make your own additional notes. These are the fundamentals. There are additional more. You can go to Dr. Swart's website, www.the-unlimited-mind.com, and also search for her book. You can download it if you have a Kindle or any of these sort of new technology, Neuroscience for Leadership. You can also find more on my website, www.timothymaurice.com. This three-part series has been extremely enlightening to me, really understand the power of executive function, the connection between brains, bodies, and business. And I hope you find it as profitable to your life. And remember, as Viktor Frankl said, between what happens to you and your response, there is space and there's opportunity for you to exercise control and understand your position in that space, and also recognize that no matter how old you are, there's opportunity for growth, as we talked about in part one and two, and that the brain is, we still evolve in our own knowledge of the brain, and we look forward to sharing more insights with you. Dr. Swart, is there any sort of parting shot that you have from your side?
Well, I'm definitely looking forward to hearing your personal neuroplasticity story the next time that we speak. I love that quote. It's beautiful. I think that it's about choice. It's about being deliberate. It's about paying attention. And it's about being mindful. And, you know, that's actually all we can ask from ourselves.
Awesome. There are extraordinary people out there doing amazing things. And we want to thank you for tuning in. And we'll be back soon for our next three-part series. Stay on the lookout. You'll follow us online. You can follow us on social media as well, and you can get all the details on my website as well as on Dr. Tara Swart's website. Thank you.
Unbranded on cliffcentral.com.
Business leaders around the globe are committing to building a better world for everyone. cliffcentral.com is joining forces with the Sympathy Sleepout, taking a stand for the plight of the homeless. We invite you to participate with us in the Sympathy Sleepout on the 28th of July, 2016. Join the ranks of leaders of change by using your influence for what truly matters. Sign up now for the Sympathy Sleepout on www.theceosleepoutza.co.za. That's theceosleepoutza.co.za.
This is cliffcentral.com.
Hello, hello. You are tuned into the Cyber Health feature with me, Rianette Labovitz. I'm from SafetyNet Cyber Safety, and our mission is to ensure that people understand what it entails to be responsible digital citizens. And today, I would like to share tips with you on how to keep your information safe, both your personal data and your company's information. And I would like to give you a heads up about a scam that is selling fake tickets to the Olympic Games. So listen up, if you are an Olympic Games fan, beware. Scammers are selling fake tickets to the Olympic Games in Rio de Janeiro. And Kaspersky Lab experts found the first spam emails mentioning the Olympic Games early in 2015 already. And it's a year before the event. And the majority of the spam emails are in English, but some are also in Portuguese because of the location of this year's Olympic Games. According to the Kaspersky Lab research, international fraudsters and gangs are also behind the creation of fake ticketing services for the Olympic Games. Major events attract spammer attention because they are a good opportunity to earn more from gullible people, and we all can just lose concentration for a moment and click on the wrong thing. So listen up. The most frequent topic of these emails is fake lottery wins for the ticket lottery organized by the International Olympic Committee and the Brazilian government. Spammers are attempting to convince victims that their email address has been chosen randomly, and that's quite surprising, from a large list. To receive their prize, the victim must reply to the email and provide personal information. Spam emails are not only the only threats, though, faced to us and for by us as users. Ticketing services are also appearing for the Rio de Janeiro 2016 Olympic Games, and these are the most dangerous threat. The Kaspersky Lab team constantly detects and blocks counterfeit domains with Rio or Rio 2016 in the title. Malicious web pages discovered by Kaspersky Lab have been very well made, so we have to realize that there are experts sitting behind these these scams. The business model used by the fraudsters is fairly simple. On phishing websites, users have been asked to provide personal information, including bank account details. And please, come on, our banks warn us, don't ever share that. And then they ask you to pay for the fake Olympic tickets. After extracting this information, criminals use it to steal money from the victim's bank accounts. To sound even more convincing, the fraudsters are informing their victims that they will receive their tickets 2 or 3 weeks before the actual event. And we wait and we wait, and then we are so pleasantly surprised or shockingly surprised when the time comes and it was untrue. Andrew Kosten is a senior web content analyst at Kaspersky Lab, and he warns that, according to their research, the creation of fake sites usually involves well-organized, fraudulent international gangs. They split tasks so that each small group is responsible for a separate part of the work. For example, one group creates the websites, the other registers the domains, another collects and sells the victim's personal information, etc. So what should we do? How do we keep safe? To make your internet purchasing safe, Kaspersky Lab recommends not buying anything from tickets to the Olympics or the Olympic souvenirs on the online stores advertised through spam or suspicious advertising banners. The company also recommends having a separate bank account and a card with a small amount of money on it for online payments. And this is a good tip to keep in mind in any case, to use a separate account for any online purchases. And it reminds me of a show I did a couple of months ago where we spoke about safe online banking and purchasing stuff online. And it's to rather use a separate account with just a little bit of money or enough money for you to do your purchase. So should that information be hacked or stolen, then at least you don't lose all the money in your main business or bank account. So to stay safe and ensure your security software is up to date and make sure that it includes anti-phishing and anti-spam tools to help you keep your personal data safe and your money secure. And I want to add, and your company's information, because we have a responsibility if we use company laptops and devices. You can also go to a blog post. It's called securelist.com to find lots more information. And then I would like to share some additional tips and just to keep you aware and make you think twice before you make the wrong decision. So one is, don't charge your phone by connecting it to another or someone that you don't know's laptop or machine, or it could even be someone that you know. Because the moment you connect it, they get access to your phone's data, and they are connected in a way that should there be ransomware, should there be any, you know, malicious code on that machine, it could be transferred to your phone. And don't leave your laptop unlocked and unattended at a restaurant. I see it so often where people work at a restaurant and they quickly leave their machines, and most of the times it's not even locked. Someone can quickly and easily insert a USB stick or a memory stick and infect your machine in that way. Be careful when you receive a USB memory stick as a gift or an incentive. Like, many times we walk around in a shopping mall and they've got a really good promotion going and you get this USB. Make sure that it's safe or that you've got your machine guarded against any viruses. And then when you use your memory stick to transfer data, make sure that your memory stick doesn't have malware or any viruses and so forth. So we must just ensure that we are protected and that we think twice before we purchase online, look at the source where you get the information from. And there is so much more we need to be considering, and we look forward to sharing more with you. But please join us on Facebook at SafetyNet. It's S-A-V-E-T, Net, SafetyNet. And join the conversation on Twitter and Facebook. Thanks so much. And remember, travel safely on the digital highway.
Unbranded on CliffCentral.com.